You're listening to part two of episode 549 of Unwelcome Guests. We continue with the radio adaptation of the film Poison Fire.
In England, the Western world, we are dying here.
The image cuts to two Nigerians giving small change to a busker in Amsterdam.
If he had travelled to the Netherlands together with Adaka from Environmental Rights Action, they were to attend Shell's annual general meeting with the company shareholders.
It should be a campaign. Everybody just goes in front of the oil company, strip off their clothes, and pee on their floor. That'd be very good. The gods will cost them, you know?
The judge in Nigeria had set a date for when Shell must present a plan for how they were going to stop flaring.
Ify Lott is practicing the question she hopes she can ask at the 2006 Shell shareholders AGM.
My question is, the court has ordered... Okay, let me get serious. And for you, Shell, to come up with a plan, are you going to present that plan? Yes or no?
Yeah!
The scene shifts to outside the AGM, where a variety of activists are trying to draw attention to the issue. One is carrying an eternal flame marked Gas Flare Nigeria. A large banner is erected entitled Shell Flares and Spills, Nigerians Pay the Bills.
I want to hear your views as per the case that is coming up on the 31st of May this month. Will you want to stop gas flares?
Yep. We fully agree that the flare should stop it, and we are working.
You're about to
thank you very much. Okay. Now I just come outside to say hello to you and to shake your hand.
I appreciate
that you are coming. Okay, nice to meet you. Where are you from?
Nigeria.
Yeah, from where? Bayelsa State as well.
And my wish is for you people to stop gas flaring. It's dangerous.
No problem. But I come back to that in the meeting, even in my initial work, I will say well, something. Yeah. Thank you for coming.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, I am.
Thank you.
Shaking hands with Jeroen van der Veel, the CEO of Shell. We can't gather people were there for Russia, people were there for Ireland, people were there for Philippines, people were there for South Africa, people were there for Nigeria. Make all of us gather, go there like one voice. You understand? So, this is not me. Make an listen to what they talk.
I'm the country chair for Nigeria. I'm the MD of Shell.
It's
the government who made the law. They told us, if you sabotage, we cannot pay compensation. You understand what I mean? But you can, of course, we don't listen to that, we still pay. But we pretend we don't pay, we call it loss of livelihood, but we don't, you get what I mean? We still do, as companies.
So you think something will be paid to the Roma people?
Yes, obviously, and we...
Nothing this man don't do for us.
What he are saying is wrong.
Yes, obviously.
Because he only wants to buy the Oyinbo papers. To just close our eye. Anything that for us, for our good, he has not given us anything.
We've cleaned up 75% of it. Of the ones that are left, 80% of that will be done this year.
This part of the film cuts frequently between Nigeria and Amsterdam. It shows how the deceptive words of the Shell executives in the meeting in Amsterdam compare with the reality on the ground. It also shows that they're being relayed by technology. Perhaps not live, but apparently recorded and sent over the internet. Nigerians are avidly watching and are aware of what is being said. The reverse does not appear to be true, so that those in Amsterdam don't have feeds much film of the reality of what's going on in Nigeria.
But there are areas, of course, where, you know, we haven't had access to go and do the cleanup. That's in Ogoniland. And as you know, the federal government is trying reconciliation because the people there don't want us to clean it up until we resolve our differences.
And he told me that Shell wants to come into Ogoni and clean up Ogoni. But the Ogoni people does not want Shell to come in and clean. So I said, okay, when I come back, I'll hear from the Ogoni people mouth too, that is it true?
A strikingly unlikely reversal of the claims of the local Nigerians that Shell was violently denying them access to their own land. This is the Nigerian spokesman for Shell claiming at the AGM that Shell couldn't clean up Ogoni land because it was being denied access to it by the locals, who presumably didn't want them to clean it up. This is Chief Menotomi of the Goi tribe of Ogoni, stating that Shell has never come there to try and clean it up, in spite of frequent appeals to them to do so. A case where better coordination and communication could have assisted those who are trying to sort truth from lies.
Shell has never one day in this community that they are coming to clean and we refuse. They have never. We have been appealing to them to come and do the cleaning. Not talk of damages. They don't even do compensation.
But I would have thought that if environment is very important, they will let us go clean it up.
I want to survive, but they can't survive. They are dying. Look at it. They are dying. Dying. So we don't know what to do. Somebody will tell you that you don't want to live in an environment that is clean. But Shell said we like to stay in the dirty place and environment, which is not to be clean. Is that possible?
Cut back to the Nigerian spokesman outside the AGM, whose body language tells a story. He's holding a few files of papers, pressed tightly to his chest, with his arms folded in front of him while he speaks.
There's this ruling in Benin by George that Shell should come up with a detailed plan on how they're going to stop gas flow.
The plan is this with the federal government.
So yeah. Is Shell going to present it on the 31st of May this year?
Yeah, I don't know what we have a plan.
Insightful and skeptical analysis comes from an audience of red-eyed and obviously distressed-looking Nigerians watching on a video.
He's just protecting his company. He's getting your money. He's just protecting his job, protecting the company. He knows what is happening. But because he wants to remain in position, he still doesn't want to lose his job, so he's just protecting his own job. He knows what is happening.
Back at the AGM, the Shell spokesman assumes a condescending posture, shakes his head knowingly, as he delivers what appears to be a prepared speech.
I don't know if you know, just like anybody in Nigeria, when you send a budget to government, they never approve the budget. They always approve. They cut it. Really, it's not... If you deal with corruption, then you would have dealt with a lot of things. And unfortunately, I know the federal government is trying to deal with corruption from the top level, but we need to deal with it from the bottom.
Oh, you say the government is corrupt and you are doing the oil. We stop them until they correct the corruption before they start.
He said that the clean-ups will they pay for lively. He has not done it. But since he's saying this, maybe it means good intention, we don't know. We'll give him the benefit of that. So because I see Omuyi as a very innocent, very nice, willing person to discuss, I can't just start pushing him to the wall that he has lied here. I don't know the reasons why he said so. We'll go there, he will show us the plan, and we will discuss.
Okay, please get your message short. Ask your question.
Video cameras were not allowed in the meeting, so the question section had to be recorded in secret.
I ask you to listen to these people. We have been waiting for a long time. There's people in Rome who would like to speak, so can we please speak?
Yeah, you're right. You said that before. Sorry.
My name is Ifeanyi Lot. I'm from Bayelsa State. A High Court judge had a ruling that Shell should present a plan on how they are going to stop gas flare. Want to know if you are going to present this plan.
Interesting that Malcolm Brinded from Shell uses the word commitment when answering that question.
Would we make a commitment to get the flares out by April 2007 and a reference to the Nigerian High Court motion with regard to that? And just for clarification, there are still legal proceedings going ahead in which we've appealed to the Court of Appeal where there is already an application in. with regard to a stay of execution on that ruling.
Interpretation this time comes from Ify Lot, who's replaying the video to a room of Nigerian men who appear to be pretty much sussing what's going on.
He was trying to put the blame back to government.
The reason why we've not been able to go faster is essentially because the funding for the venture has not been made available by the government over time. And I understand that. They have many pressing other priorities for the use of their funds.
A legal opinion comes from George Ogora, a lawyer from Port Harcourt, similarly unimpressed by the video.
The duty of pending gas flaring is squarely on the company flaring the gas, e.g. Shell Petroleum Development Company of Nigeria. It is not the federal government. The federal government has done its own part by making that law outlawing gas flaring in Nigeria.
But we are on track to complete all of the flares out by 2009, and we're all committed to wanting to do that as fast as possible.
Teller Atoni, another lawyer from Port Harcourt, is unimpressed by Shell management's claim to be committed to wanting to end gas flares. And it's he who provides a supplementary legal opinion.
It is no more a political issue.
Right, to leave, yes.
It is no more at their own discretion. Take step whenever you think you can. No, it's now a mandatory obligation. You have to do it. It is a necessity. It's a law. It's a right.
Yes.
And a duty.
Now, what you've heard was commentary on the video. Present at the meeting was Anne van Schaik from Friends of the Earth Netherlands. And this is her comment, which she made to a disgruntled-looking Shell spokesman.
You decided to deal in a country like Nigeria. You know what the government is like, that they will never give you the money to end actually gas flaring. So I suggest that Shell takes its own responsibility. If you can't handle that, then don't do business in Nigeria.
A lawyer, Norfor, comments at the Court of Appeal in Benin City.
It is a classical example of lawlessness. We have a judgment at hand which declared that gas flaring is illegal, is unconstitutional, is a violation of right to life and dignity of human person, and also asked Shell to stop further flaring of gas. That judgment is still valid, is still subsisting. It has not been set aside even by this court.
Shell are only allowed to continue on the basis that they submit to the court their detailed plan for phasing out.
Exactly.
And they failed to do that.
They have failed to do that. So there is no excuse whatsoever why they should continue to flare gas.
Yeah, well, we've had a fantastic judgment in the court in Benin City holding Shell liable for human rights violations and requiring them to stop. And that is quite a remarkable thing. And when you see Shell's business principles about complying with the law in the countries in which they operate, how dare they say that? It's complete nonsense, and it's shameful that they behave like this when a court in Nigeria tells them that they must stop gas flaring. It is absolutely disgraceful, and the great thing is that there are many communities around the Niger Delta who now have sufficient self-respect and courage to stand up to the companies and say that we're not prepared to put up with this kind of behaviour from you any longer. It's gone on for over 40 years and enough is enough.
Chima Williams, Environmental Rights Action.
In fact, Shell is above the law in Nigeria. The government has said 2008 is the deadline. Other multinational corporations have said, okay, we'll do everything possible to meet up with that target date. It's only Shell that have said, look, we will not be able to do this. We will only manage to see if we can do that by the end of 2009, which is a possibility. And this means that come 2009, they will tell you that they were unable, so they can set their own date, maybe to 2020. Or 2010 or whatever.
2050.
The city of crude oil, land where the milk and the honey flows. The glory of Nigeria, the pride of Africa. They believe it in the dark.
The main reason why I came back
to redo this video with communities because of what happened at The Hague. I was there, I asked them questions, and they were blaming my federal government, accusing us of being corrupt. My problem is that if my government is so corrupt, why do you do business with my government?
No water, water.
They have a responsibility to clean up the environment which they damage. And that is why communities keep pointing at them. They are the people they know. They are the people they see. Have I seen government pipe leaking? No. But I have seen shell pipe leaking.
Abject poverty, pollution every day, subjection, intimidation. How can they do this to you?
Now, I could have spoken in the introduction about Ken Sarawiwa, whose non-violent resistance led to the majority of the Ogoni population, hundreds of thousands of people, marching in protest. And what was the result? Well, he and the other chief organizers were murdered, and as of 2011, the gas flaring continues unabated. I'm reminded of another martyr, John F. Kennedy's quote, that those who make peaceful change impossible make violent revolution inevitable. Now, to help us appreciate the damage of that logic, the psychopathic maximization of the discrete and separate self, let's conclude the show with this recording by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock.
The following audio presentation was given by Dr. Frederica Pereira of Columbia University at a briefing for congressional staff held March 30th, 2005 at the Harvard Medical School.
Some of you may have seen the New York Times story last month titled Pollution is Linked to Fetal Harm. This story highlighted Dr. Pereira's groundbreaking research. She, with her colleagues, followed some 60 newborns and their non-smoking mothers in low-income parts of Harlem and the Bronx, and showed that high levels of pollutant exposure, mostly from vehicle exhaust, were associated with higher levels of genetic abnormalities of the type associated with a greater risk of getting cancer. Frederica Pereira is a professor of environmental health sciences and director, as she mentioned in the introductions, of the Center for Children's Environmental Health at the School of Public Health at Columbia. And for many years, she's been monitoring a variety of pollutants, including polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, fine particulates, pesticides, tobacco smoke, heavy metals, and assessing the health risks associated with these exposures. She's done some work following 9/11 with exposures from all of the burning materials of the Twin Towers on populations exposed. And it's a great pleasure for me to introduce Professor Frederica Pereira.
Well, thank you very much for this introduction, and I'm really very happy to be here, to be let out of the research, the ivory tower in the laboratory, so to speak, to talk with you. I really am representing a large group of people. There are over 40 researchers in our center, so this is a group effort. I gave you some readings, as Eric said. I gave you a couple of things to read. The article in Environmental Health Perspectives is outdated, and I updated it in the notes attached to the abstract that is also in your folder, with the results that we have obtained since 2001, really, when that earlier article was written. That article was written just at the very beginning of this prospective cohort study that I'll be talking about. So let me give you a little background. I think you're all aware that asthma rates in children have increased dramatically in recent years. There's been a reported doubling in incidence rates in the last 20 years. And a recent study confirmed that 25% of elementary school children in Harlem had asthma. In our own cohort, we're seeing rates of 30%. This is indeed a very, very serious problem. And developmental problems have also been increasing, even accounting for improved diagnosis. rates of learning disabilities, ADHD, attention hyperactivity, attention hyperactivity disorder, and autism have increased, and an estimated 15% of elementary or school children in the U.S. have at least one learning disability. So this is a major problem. And childhood cancer is a rare disease, but over 12,000 children are diagnosed each year with cancer, and most commonly leukemia and brain cancer. And there's some evidence that there, too, the rates have been increasing about 1% a year in incidence for those cancers. So that's the background. We have a serious problem, and the etiology, the causation of these diseases, is not well understood. However, environmental factors are suspected and, in some cases, known to contribute. The other backdrop to this is the disproportionate exposure to toxic pollutants in underserved communities. And this is a pattern that you see nationwide. We see it in New York City, more siting of diesel bus depots and heavily trafficked bus truck roadways. And polluting sources tend to be located, clustered in those areas. And so there is an environmental justice issue. The third point, which I'm going to come back to again in more detail, is the greater susceptibility of the very young, the fetus and the child, to a number of different toxic chemicals, toxic pollutants, and I'll go through the biologic reasons for that. I mentioned the causes are complex. In addition to environmental exposures, which are either known or suspected to contribute, and the vulnerability of the young, what are referred to as toxic social conditions also are clearly playing a role. Another term for this is psychosocial factors due to things like material hardship, poverty, the stress of living in social disadvantage. And that's an important factor that we're attempting to capture in our research, along with nutritional susceptibility factors, say low levels of antioxidants and other micronutrients that might put a child at greater risk, a fetus at greater risk, and then genetic factors. And I'm not talking about the hard drive genes like BRCA1, which are by themselves explain a certain proportion of, in that case, breast cancer. But I'm talking about common variations. We all have them. 50% of us have a variant in a gene called GSTM1, and this is the gene that clears, detoxifies the chemicals, a number of the chemicals I'm going to talk about, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons and the pesticide chlorpyrifos. And so you want to have an active form of the gene. 50% of us have a deletion in that particular gene. So we're not so good at handling that exposure. So what we're doing in our research, and it's very important to do this, is attempting to capture all of these variables, put them together, and then tease apart the contribution of the ones that we can readily prevent and readily address. Pollutants have multiple effects. I've just lined up a few, the pollutants that we're focusing on. Why? Because these are very common in the urban environment and elsewhere as well. The air pollutants that come from combustion products, energy sources are a major source. Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAH, particulate matter, and diesel exhaust particulate. Now, just look on the right, and you see the abbreviations for cancer, development, and asthma. In parentheses, the point of that slide is that there are multiple effects, and for the PAHs, they are known carcinogens, developmental toxicants, and I'm referring to in experimental animals and or humans. And now there's beginning to be evidence that they also contribute to the causation of asthma. That is, prenatal exposures can contribute. And same thing with particulate matter. You see all three effects listed, and diesel exhaust, two of the effects of concern. I think if you could just turn that off, it doesn't want to die, so to speak. Sorry, I apologize. I meant to do that. Pesticides, organophosphate pesticides, have been widely used to control residential pests like cockroaches and other insects and other vermin, and they've turned out to be toxic in their own right, just as the organochlorines were. Is it off? There is experimental evidence of developmental toxicity, and I'll show you some preliminary results from our study. Also showing that effect, and asthma and carcinogenicity are just suggested. But again, this picture of multiplicity of effects. Environmental tobacco smoke, also a real witch's brew of chemicals that exert all three of the effects of concern. And lead and mercury, classic developmental toxicants, among the best studied of all the environmental pollutants. And of course, allergens play a role in asthma. So we were quite ambitious in this research, and we're attempting to document exposures to all of these and to look at the effects of each one singly and then also in combination, because the real world, of course, is that you get exposed to all of these things. And previous studies have looked at one particular exposure at a time. Now, back to this key issue that I can't hammer home enough. It is this heightened susceptibility in the developing fetus and young child. For many pollutants, at these life stages, the individual has differentially higher exposure. For the fetus, there's greater absorption and retention of certain toxicants, and that's true for the child as well. For the young child who is eating a great deal more food, ingesting a lot more food and water on a body weight basis than an adult, any pollutants in the food and water will also be ingested by that developing child. And then, of course, mouthing objects, crawling, that's another vector for exposure in the young child. So there's greater exposure, absorption, retention, but also the systems that we have operating we adults have operating at varying efficiencies, but much better than in the fetus and child, to detoxify chemicals and repair the damage they do to DNA are immature and not efficient in this early developmental period. And then the higher rate of cell proliferation puts cells, DNA, genes at risk and offers the potential for disruption in normal differentiation and growth. And then, of course, for carcinogens, there's just a lot more time for cancer to develop if the cancer is initiated as early as in utero. So there is concern about this window of exposure and susceptibility, and imagine what the preventive benefits could be if we could really take steps to protect this very sensitive period. Molecular epidemiology is a big mouthful, and it really is rather simple. It says what it looks like what it is. It's molecular biology fused with epidemiology, which is the study of the causes of human disease, as you know. And in our research, what we are doing, and this approach is now being widely used, but what the approach is not only to monitor exposures and monitor exposures with backpack monitors or indoor-outdoor home monitoring or ambient air monitors and ask people about exposure through questionnaires and interviews, but not only to obtain the clinical outcomes through clinical assessments of developmental disorders or asthma, or in the case of cancer risk in our study, since our numbers are not large enough to have clinical cancer as an outcome, we're using chromosomal abnormalities as a proxy, because that's a biomarker that has been validated as a predictor of cancer risk in adults. And so the inference is that it's also bad news in children. And the biomarkers that we're looking at include these listed here. Biomarkers of exposure, such as blood levels of pesticides or lead, mercury. Also, a marker that tells you a bit more than just the chemical got into the body and was absorbed and is there. This is a marker of genetic damage from, say, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, where the chemical has actually hit the DNA and latched onto it, and you can measure those fingerprints. Another marker is, immune changes, which can predispose to asthma and also to cancer, or at least cooperate in that process. And then susceptibility markers, I mentioned the genetic variants, and also the micronutrients. Those can be directly measured. And so we get a full picture in this way of the exposures, the molecular changes they induce, or the susceptibility factors that might exacerbate their effects, and then the clinical outcomes. So this is a sort of molecular profiling, if you will, of exposure and risk. Okay. Okay, so the center is aimed at preventing disease by conducting a comprehensive assessment of exposures and risks during the early developmental periods in prenatally and postnatally, and develop strategies to reduce and eliminate, hopefully, ultimately prevent those risks. And we hypothesize that these exposures play a role in all three diseases or disorders of concern, that nutritional and genetic factors and social stressors modify those impacts, and also that interventions can reduce environmental risk to children. This slide is really summarizing the study, I think, in a useful way without bogging you down in the details. We're enrolling, and this is the study that we're doing in northern Manhattan, in Harlem, Washington Heights, and the Bronx. And we are looking at 730 non-smoking women. We took out smoking so as not to swamp out the other exposures of concern, and their children. We enroll in pregnancy, and we do monitoring questionnaires. We monitor, and I'll show you the backpack we use, personal air monitoring. We also monitor the homes, indoor-outdoor air, and conduct questionnaire interviews with questionnaires. And then we have geographic information system or computerized mapping also as a tool to estimate exposure and to plot our data. And then we have the series of biomarkers that I told you about earlier, and then the clinical outcomes. And these measures are repeated. They're taken during pregnancy, at delivery, and then repeated over the child's early years. Not all of them, but everything here is done during pregnancy and at delivery, and then in childhood, a little bit more selective. And this is a GIS just showing the residences of the women in the cohort. And let's see, orient yourself. There's the GW Bridge at the top there, which I look out at from my office window. And what we have found so far, I'm just going to give you a few highlights. The fetus is exposed to multiple toxicants. Air monitoring and questionnaire indicate that every single air sample taken during pregnancy, therefore every mother and every fetus, had prenatal exposure to PAHs and pesticides in air. And the levels did vary, and they appear to vary as a function of proximity of residents to major roadways, heavily trafficked roadways, and other things that you would intuitively say or would be predictors, but that we are actually documenting. And 40% of the babies were prenatally exposed to environmental tobacco smoke, and that's through questionnaire confirmed by cotinine in the blood. The biomarkers taken at that's in cord blood or in maternal blood. I think here I just shown you the cord blood. But at delivery, we take a small sample of umbilical cord blood, also collect the placenta, and then a sample of the mother's blood at the same time of delivery or after delivery, and then analyze these for the different biomarkers. And here are some of the findings. The adducts, the PAH DNA damage in the form of fingerprints or adducts, we call them because these two things have come together and become adducted. They are detected in 40% of newborn cord bloods. And the pesticides, chlorpyrifos, diazinon, those are both organophosphates, and propoxir are detected in 100%, and or propoxir detected in all of the cord blood samples. Yes.
Does the placenta provide any kind of barrier to large chemicals?
Yes, it does. The placenta is intended to do that, and it does do that. It reduces, it's been estimated from experimental studies that it reduces the level of PAHs, for example, by a factor of 10. And yet, I'll show you some findings that we have that suggest that even despite that protection, the fetus being more sensitive, less able to detoxify and repair damage, actually has as much or more DNA damage than the mother.
Is it an issue of molecular size, or is
it's it's an issue of size and also the actual the structure, but it varies by chemical. And some chemicals just zip right across, and chlorpyrifos is an example of something that goes straight across. Prenatal exposures reduce fetal growth. Fetal growth, why is fetal growth important? Well, fetal growth is actually a very good predictor. Birth weight particularly has been particularly studied. Good predictor of later health and cognitive development of the child. So lower birth weight, even in the normal range, is associated with not only more health problems in childhood and adulthood, but less good functioning at school and less good scoring on cognitive tests and so forth, and even decreased IQ. So there is a concern about reducing fetal growth, and both PAHs and environmental tobacco smoke are associated with reductions in birth size. The when we looked at the adducts as a biomarker, not only of exposure but also of actual dose to the what we call a biologically effective dose, and we looked at combined exposure to these two things, the adducts of PAHs and ETS, we found that birth weight was quite sharply reduced. Here, this slide has become flipped, so. This is backwards, but just to show you, these are the kids, the babies, who have prenatal ETS exposure and have high levels of PAH DNA adducts in the cord blood, and their birth weight is significantly lower than those who do not have both of the exposures, who have one but not both. And then on the other side, again, flipped, so it's too bad, but birth weight is sharply reduced. It, for those babies who had the highest quartile of exposure to chlorpyrifos in cord blood. And those decrements, those reductions in birth size, are really in the range of what you see in mothers who are actively smoking. So there's significant reductions, and this is the average for the group, and some babies have obviously much larger reductions. So that was a finding of concern because of this link to later development and later problems. And the children are being followed, and here's a snapshot at age 2 using the Bayley test. Is anyone familiar with that? Maybe you've had, no? This is a standard test that is repeated during the early years. This is a two-year testing where the child is asked to perform certain, certain tasks, fitting shapes into the board and so. And there's a mental development part of the test in a psychomotor development part. And you can see that here this is a very little pointer, but here are the babies who have no prenatal ETS exposure. Now, I should just make this very clear. ETS exposure by itself was harmful. So by itself, not considering the psychosocial stress, because here we've looked at, and I say we, this is Virginia Rao, who has headed up this part of the research, we've looked at the effects of material hardship. That is, mothers saying that they had inadequate food, shelter, or clothing during pregnancy for themselves or for their child, their family. And so here's 0 material hardships, 1 or 2 or more. And you can see that the babies who have no, the children who have no prenatal ETS do better, although there is an effect of having material hardship, the mother having had material hardship during pregnancy. But if there's a combination of prenatal ETS and material hardship, you see a sort of dose-related decrease in the score on this Bayley's mental development test. And it is a significant increase in developmental delay. So, developmental delay on the Bayley's, what does that mean? It's a pretty good predictor of school performance. And in fact, a low score on this test, and we do this routinely, it means that we refer those children, the mothers, to an early intervention program that is run by the state. And there are expenses to do with that program. But, of course, not to mention the fact that that child has a decreased mental development, which may play out later in many aspects of his or her life. And here's another follow-up. We're here this time. Now the babies are getting older, so are we. But they're now actually, we're starting to look at four and five-year-old tests, and we're now funded to go into second grade with them, which is going to be interesting. But here are the results at up to 36 months, repeat testing, 12, 24, and 36 months. And again, for chlorpyrifos exposure, and this is using cord blood as the measure of exposure, what do we find? We find that psychomotor development is affected by, and this is preliminary data. It's in preparation, so it's not to be quoted. There may be some changes, minor changes, but this is holding up. And the low chlorpyrifos babies do significantly better. You can see that there's not too much difference at 12 months. 24 months and 36 months, they're doing significantly better than the high chlorpyrifos babies. And that's, I think, an important finding. And based on the animal tests, this is the first human study that has looked at this, the animal tests would also suggest that psychomotor function would be affected by this pesticide, which works by inhibition of acetylcholinesterase. You probably have heard of that. So this is, we think, an important finding. Yes. Yes.
Is the low chlorpyrifos number, is that analogous to the national average?
The low chlorpyrifos. Oh, these are very. This is in our. No, this is. We allowed our data to tell. To distinguish high low. We use basically, the high chlorpyrifos is the upper quartile. And the other and the low is everyone else. And I'll tell you why we did that. Because and I'll also tell you the rest of the story. Should I tell you? There's some good news in here too. Should I keep the good news to the end, or should
we love good news.
You want it now? Okay. All right. Okay. I'll tell you the good news. So this is a nasty chemical, and EPA acted in 2001 and 2002 to phase out the residential use of this pesticide and also diazinon, and almost immediately we saw a drop in cord blood levels. And the effects on birth weight, we haven't yet looked at these at the effects on this outcome, but I am certain the effects on birth weight were no longer there. And the baby still had some residue because there's residual amount, but very drastically lower and much better birth outcomes. And I think we'll see benefits here as well. So that's kind of providing some confirmation that intervention in the form of a regulation like that has some very major good news attached. Yeah.
Could you say, were these pesticides being used in the home?
Yes. They were being used in the home. They're also used on crops, and unfortunately they are still being used on certain crops. Chlorpyrifos is still present in the food supply. But the overwhelming exposure in New York City, the urban area, particularly in under-maintained, poor-quality housing, is for residential use. And the apartment buildings were being treated by exterminators using this, and then...
These weren't being applied by the residents.
Oh, yes, they were. Raid and other products containing this stuff. It's no longer in these products, and because of the law. So, yes, it was in the homes because of the monthly treatment by exterminators, and also, you know, the families or the household members were going out and buying the stuff.
How long could it stay in the home now that it's been banned? How long can it
stay? Yeah, well, everyone thought organophosphate's so great, pesticides are so great because they won't, they're not going to last a long time like the organochlorines, like DDT. However, they actually have quite a long lifetime. Particularly, you know, they're in the rugs and in the materials, and they're so that there's a residual there that is, so we're still seeing measurable levels in quite a few of our children, but sharply reduced. So it's not a problem that just disappears like that, but markedly improved. Okay. Now, I haven't talked too much about asthma, but I did mention at the beginning the multiple effects of the same exposure. And Rachel Miller, who's a pulmonary physician and immunologist in our center, heading up the asthma work, has recently published with colleagues the finding that the babies had more respiratory problems at ages 1 and 2 years if they had had prenatal PAH exposure, and in this case, postnatal ETS exposure. Now, this looks like the baby's drinking a bottle of milk. What is it? Yeah. And here's a child, I don't think you can see this very well, being tested by spirometry. And the only way you can really confirm asthma is at age 5 or so, when you can get the child to, you know, to breathe into this spirometer and do the full clinical testing. But at ages 1 and 2, these babies have more respiratory problems, and 30% of them moms have been told that their babies are likely to or definitely have asthma they've been told by the physicians. So we are confirming that. I think that's somewhat of a little bit of an overestimate, but not too different from what was found in Harlem school children. Okay, now I'm going to just give you a few slides on the carcinogenicity aspect, and I mentioned we don't have actual clinical cases of cancer for the reason that we only have 700 or so children, and the disease is too rare to look at that outcome. But I just want to make the point that we are using these what we call pro-carcinogenic markers or cancer risk markers that have been validated in many other studies shown to be associated with increased risk of cancer. And so they can give us a sort of early warning, so to speak, if not the clinical. They don't give us the clinical outcome. Here's benzpyrene, a classic PAH. Now, it gets acted on by all these different enzymes, and I mentioned the GSTs. You want to have those active to clear, but also, so it can be cleared that way, but it's also activated by these enzymes. And then you get this ultimate reactive intermediate, which hits the DNA and binds to guanine in DNA and forms this very stable covalently bonded base, covalently bonded adduct, I should say. And so the adduct is here in red, and it can be repaired if your system is doing that efficiently, and if it's done in time before the cell divides, that's good. But it can also lead to mutation and ultimately to cancer, but other things do have to happen. The cancer is a process that involves multiple steps. But this is thought to be a triggering early, the triggering, or one of the triggering events in carcinogenesis. So that's a marker that is considered to be a pro-carcinogenic marker. And we were talking earlier about the placenta being protective, and even despite that tenfold reduction in the actual amount of estimated, in this case, benzpyrene or PAHs crossing the placenta and reaching the fetus, the newborn or the cord blood actually had as much or more of the adducts than the mother's blood. And so this is the cord blood, and this is the mother's blood in northern Manhattan. Now, this is the World Trade Center cohort, which I haven't mentioned to you, but we are doing a study of mothers and newborns, 320 or so mothers and their children, exposed to varying degrees to the World Trade Center air pollutants. We also have a parallel study, the one in New York done in Poland, and another in China. And you can see, and energy use, and particularly fossil fuel burning, can sort of apart from this one, this is a special issue. But if you look at these three scenarios, you see a nice sort of dose response, if you will, corresponding to the increased levels of these PAHs in air in these different places. Poland in Krakow, the Krakow region, has considerable coal and uncontrolled vehicle emissions, and China is fiercely dependent on coal right now, and so you see a lot of that pollutant. So here we have the finding that despite the protection of the fetus, of the placenta, the fetus is highly sensitive, possibly tenfold more sensitive to DNA damage than the mother. And as I showed you in the last slide, that's an indication that, cancer risk might be increased to a, from given the same dose of PAH, might be increased disproportionately when it is received during the fetal period, which is so susceptible. Okay. This is the study that Eric just mentioned to you, and that we looked at chromosomal aberrations. And again, studies that have followed very large numbers of subjects for years and years in the Nordic countries and Italy have shown that when you take the look at the chromosomal aberrations in blood from healthy volunteers, and then they're followed for decades, that the levels of chromosomal abnormalities, elevated chromosomal abnormalities, were good predictors of cancer risk overall, and particularly for cancers of the, well, lymphoma and leukemia particularly. So we use this as another marker of potential risk of cancer. But I have to say, adducts and chromosomal aberrations don't mean the child is going to get cancer. We're not saying that. We're saying that there is a potential increase in risk and that we should pay attention to it because of the supporting data. And here we painted chromosomes. This is a really neat technique that is called, well, I won't tell you what FISH stands for. Well, I will, fluorescent in situ hybridization, so, because I know a lot of you are into oceans and fisheries and just want to clarify. And so this is a way of visualizing the different chromosomes by having them light up in different colors. And I don't think you can see this so well. But chromosome 2 lights up red, and chromosome 5 green. And normally, a chromosome is all one color. It's not supposed to be bicolors and have stripes and things like that. But here you have a rearrangement whereby a piece of 5 is attached to a piece along the long arm of chromosome 2. And here's the reciprocal rearrangement. That's not good, because these large-scale rearrangements are very stable, persistent, and they are one of the types of abnormalities that are linked to increased risk of cancer. And we found, looking at the levels of PAHs measured by backpack, I sort of skipped over that, but the moms wear a backpack during pregnancy or keep it by the bed at night. It's only for 48 hours, so it's just a snapshot, but it seems to be telling us important things about variation in exposure. And the airborne PAHs measured by these pumps, these in the filters of these air pumps worn during pregnancy, were significantly associated with stable aberration frequencies in cord blood. And that was after controlling for, I should say, all these results are adjusting for other risk factors or confounding variables. I didn't want to bog you down with it. But that was that's a significant finding, because the only other study like similar to this, and this was in 60 newborns, a representative sample from our cohort. The only other studies of this type have involved 20 or so subjects and have looked at mothers' active smoking. And I'm just about done. Good. And I just want to point out that we're not very good at this, and I think it's something we've got to get better at, which is doing the economics on some of these health effects. But if you just, I mentioned the early intervention program, and if you just add up the numbers of the costs for early intervention in New York City, it's $450 million a year for treatment of children who are referred. So that's just per year. The cost of medical care for American children with asthma in 2002, $7 billion. IQ decrements, and we're not yet measuring IQ. We are going to at age five. But the development scores that we have measured are good sort of indicators of how a child will do on IQ. And the decrements that we see are, I'm not going to compare them directly to mercury, but just give you a sense of the cost of a drop in just 1% at 1 point IQ on average, or a couple of points. It's, for mercury, estimated to result economic productivity loss of over almost $9 billion annually. And I think Joel Schwartz had a hand in that analysis, if I remember correctly. So the cost of these, if you want to monetize, I thought we can talk, I mean, the social and individual costs are huge, but we also need to do more at presenting the economic cost. The good news, we already told you that because your faces were getting longer and longer. And I think it's important to tell you it's not all so grim. And the center has been working with the Department of Health and the Housing Authority in New York City and actually went in and converted the pesticide protocol to using not these toxic, neurotoxic pesticides, but integrated pest management using safer alternatives. And it's been effective, and I think that the Housing Authority is considering using that citywide in all of the public housing. And we've come to Harvard and talked with Jack Spengler about that. So I think that was a success. And we've widely disseminated educational materials in Spanish and English to women in the study in the community. So these are the conclusions. Prenatal exposures to pollutants can increase risk of childhood disease and developmental disorders. And they can interact, the pollutants can interact with each other and with psychosocial factors to increase risk. Health effects have significant costs. Interventions can reduce risk. And then finally, policy translation is something we're trying to do more of. And you're very good at that, Eric, and others here. And you, of course, are doing it. What we've done locally is support community groups like West Harlem Environmental Action initiatives to reduce transportation-related air pollution and pesticide use. And then we briefed the State Attorney General's office on pesticide risks and IPM. And nationwide, we've provided information, written materials, and briefings to legislators. Here's one of the babies in our study. And I want to acknowledge all the people who have done this work. And CDC is so invaluable to us. Anyone out there who can help with this? CDC laboratories have done an extraordinary job in working with our laboratory to analyze the pesticides, metals, and other particular chemicals in our biologic samples. And their budget has been cut, and that program is under considerable stress. And I can't tell you how important it is, not just our center, but several of the other National Children's Health Environmental Health Centers, and there are 12 of us, and several of us are doing this kind of study, and they're invaluable. Thank you.
This previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download as MP3s from unwelcomeguest.net/archive. There's a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for any discussion relevant to the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep doing your thing.